And with the federal health authorities recommending that people should consider wearing masks, the Oregon Health Authority says staying home and avoiding all non-essential contact is the best. Valley weather, clear overnight with a low of 40. I'm Dale Cranford, News Radio 1240 KQEN.
The following program is paid for by CHI Mercy Medical Center. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Each weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now, Talking Health, presented by CHI Mercy Health. Now, here's Talking Health with Lisa Platt on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
As you might imagine, Lisa Platt still busily occupied with a number of things involving the Mercy Foundation and Mercy Medical during this time of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so I'm doing this program for the next few weeks as we continue on. Kyle Bailey with you this afternoon, and joining us from Douglas County's Public Health Office, Public Health Officer, Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, and from the Douglas Public Health Network, one of the epidemiologists, Laura Turpin. And folks, thanks for being on this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And of course, as folks have been noticing over the past week or so, we've moved to doing all our interviews via phone or similar means. It's kind of a different thing when you're used to looking people in the eye across the room, and it's provided another experience here as we navigate through these tough times. Well, Dr. Bob, we've been updating throughout the weeks here since January. Kind of give us a big picture. Let's start on the sort of the international level. Where are things at with COVID-19 right now?
Well, at the worldwide level, COVID is spreading rapidly. So we're now well over a million cases. We just hit 1 million cases on Friday. Now we're almost 1.4 million. So it's really spreading rapidly in many countries of the world. And with that, the death rate is continuing to increase.
And what about for the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. has also had a very rapid increase in cases. Much in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, but we've also seen big outbreaks in Louisiana, in Indiana, and in Detroit.
And of course, here on the West Coast, California, and particularly our neighbor to the north, Washington State, seems like they've gotten hit pretty hard.
Yeah, so California and Washington were two of the early states, and they've continued to have outbreaks, and they are starting to get this under control, but I think what they're showing us is going to be slow moving and hard work.
And then talk about Oregon and Douglas County. Where are we at this afternoon?
Well, thank goodness, Oregon has had one of the better experiences in the country. So when I look at the rate per thousand in Oregon, it's one of the lowest in the country, and our growth of cases has been relatively low. And I attribute that really to the excellent job that we've done with social distancing and the great job that our public health teams have done. In addition, Douglas County is even slower than that. So we're just at 12 cases now, which is much fewer than we thought we would have at this time. And again, I attribute that to the really good work that Douglas County residents have done by staying home, maintaining social distance, and really paying attention to what we say.
In just the past few days, you've had a couple of more of these drive-through clinics, one Friday in Roseburg. You were on with us from there, and then I understand you did one Saturday in Reedsport as well.
That's right. So Friday we did Roseburg, and then Saturday we did Reedsport in the pouring rain.
And talk about getting out to Reedsport. How different was it to do it there? Kind of tell us about where you did it and how it worked.
So we did it at the Public Works Shop, which was a nice protected area, except from the rain. And we were able to go ahead and do 9, which was a good amount for Reedsport. And we got it done in about 1 hour.
And again, these are all folks who were asked to be part of this via their doctor contacting DPHN.
Right. So these were people who were sick. And again, the reason we're doing people to sick who are sick first, because they have the highest likelihood of being positive. And so we swabbed 9 people who had some cough and fever. Although we're not being super strict on the criteria. If your doctor thinks you need a test, you should get it.
So what's the plan for more of these drive-through clinics?
Well, we're going to be there again tomorrow. I think Dr. Royal and Grant, who's one of the nurses, is going to be helping them. We're going to do these at the fairgrounds. We only had 10 as of this morning, but we'll continue to take these through tomorrow morning.
I know there was a concern you mentioned last week just in terms of some of the supplies for testing. Ironically, some of those actually coming from one of the hard-hit areas in Italy. Have you had better luck finding more of what you need?
Well, we've not had any luck in finding more swabs, although we were able to get some more of the vials that you need to put it in. And Northwest Compounding Pharmacy was able to do those for us, but it wasn't without a tremendous amount of problems. So, for example, the FDA had to get involved to allow us to do this.
Wow. So how does that work when you need to change something to make it work, and then you've got to go clear up to the federal level and really with no time to turn things around? How'd you make that happen?
Well, Congressman DeFazio's office has been tremendously helpful in prodding people along to do several things. So this is one of several things they've helped prod the federal response with.
And people continue to ask me about these fast tests. Where does that stand today?
So there are two kinds of tests. One is the antibody test, and that's a blood test. But that really will be best to tell if you've had this in the past rather than now. In terms of the test for rapid diagnosis, there's the nose swabs, and they can be done at a foreign lab. But then they've also set up kits where people can do these locally. And so there are three companies that are making these local kits. One of them is the Abbott ID Now. Nobody in town has that setup. But there are two other setups. One is the GeneX from Cepheid, and the other one is the BioFire. And there are places in town who have those. So we're very hopeful that we'll get some of this more rapid testing within the next few weeks. And the problem with that is these testing kits are limited. So when you do it, not only do you have to have the machine, but then you also need to have the specific COVID kit, and the COVID kits are in very short supply.
And are the accuracy of the fast tests up there with the accuracy of what you've done at the drive-through clinics or that folks have done in the more traditional manner?
Yeah, so I think the rapid tests are almost as accurate as the tests we've done. Probably not more, certainly not more accurate, but maybe close to as accurate as the tests we've done.
And do you see the potential for the availability of these tests? Because you mentioned all the infrastructure you need to make them happen. Do you see that getting better soon, or is that going to be a lagging situation?
Well, there are many steps along the way where there are problems with every step. So the first step is collecting the test. It is a distinctly uncomfortable and difficult test to do, doing this nasopharyngeal swab. Again, the Q-tip needs to go in your nose for 5 inches, twirled around, and then pulled out. This is not something you could easily collect at home. And when you do collect it appropriately, people will inevitably cough on you. And since your hand is right at their nose, they're coughing right in your face. So you do need to use lots of protection. So collecting it is hard. The second are the test materials. We talked about the swabs and the viral transport media. The third is that there's a limited number of kits in foreign places, so they need to be transported and then done there. So where the timing on these is peculiar. So, for example, we have all of our tests back from the 31st, but not the ones from the clinic before. So it's hard to understand why this is taking so long, other than those labs are tremendously backlogged.
Yeah, and I imagine, are those facilities, given everything that's going on, are they set up to work around the clock? Any idea?
Well, we are told that they are working around the clock, although they, too, are limited by a limited amount of the testing material. So, again, they need the testing material, too, and some of the things called primers and other kinds of things that for this polymerase chain reaction are in very short supply around the world, because in the past we did some PCRs, so many tests a time. We're now doing many, many, many times as many PCRs because of COVID.
So I want to ask you about what seems to be this evolving situation or evolving response in the past week or so involving masks. You talked the last time we talked about what masks help with, what they don't help with. It seems like the federal guidance from the CDC and the Oregon Health Authority are somewhat differing. Tell us more about what you're being told and where things kind of stand on the mask issue today.
Well, the story on masks, as I point out, could barely be more confusing when you get different advice from different people over different periods of time. So early in February, our Surgeon General said, please don't go out and buy masks. They don't really help. And then this past week, there's been some recommendation from the CDC that you might use them, and then some recommendation from the state that, well, you could use them, but don't let it stop you from doing the other thing. So it is really quite complicated. So yesterday, I did a Mythbusters kind of thing in my garage, in my shop, and it's on our YouTube channel if people want to watch it. And so the point is that distancing is the most effective thing you can do, so being 6 feet apart. But if for some reason you can't distance, you need to be in a cab with somebody, you need to, if those exist anymore, or Uber with somebody, or if you go to the grocery store and you can't be sure there's distancing, wearing a mask can both help you a little bit from getting it, but mostly if you're going to cough or sneeze, or if you're pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic, it might help the other person in the room from getting it from you. But most important is social distancing, staying home if you're sick. Adding a mask adds a little bit more protection.
So as people go out and looking at this guidance, where are some of the places that maybe they're best used? I mean, you mentioned stores, obviously, and the grocery stores, even with the parameters that they're setting up for people staying away from each other, and it seems like people are following that pretty well. I mean, would you wear a mask, for instance, if you were working in a small office or while you're driving? What are some of the places and places not to do that?
So I've had a mask on since Saturday. Actually, it hasn't come off my neck since then. And so I've had a mask on since Saturday when the advice came out. And I pull it up when I'm at the grocery store. I pull it up when I'm around other people, when I can't adequately social distance. Once you can adequately social distance, the mask doesn't help very much. But in those places where you can't, like, you know, in the grocery store, there's this one guy who just had to be right in my face. That was a time that the mask might help.
And what about, talk about the materials. We know that different groups are out there trying to sew in different groups. I know nothing about sewing, trust me. What do people need to know if they can sew or have friends that could sew? What do they need to know about making these masks?
Well, there are many sites on the internet. The story on these masks are the construction material should be tightly woven cotton, like sheets. I think the stuff that I'm wearing right now is a tightly woven cotton that my wife made. It fits beautifully, and it works well. So tightly woven cotton will work. If you see on this Mythbusters thing, what we showed is that even a simple mask can stop almost all of the particles of a coughing or sneezing person. So again, it's most important for the person themselves who are sick. You know, I always point out that doctors in the operating room wear masks, not because they're afraid of getting sick from the patient, but it's so that their respiratory droplets don't get into the patient. So those of us of a certain age can remember a Seinfeld episode where they're watching and the junior mint winds up in the abdomen. But so it is the kind of deal that they wear this actually to protect the patient. And that's really what we're talking about, is protecting me from the person who's sick, who might be coughing or sneezing on me.
And for these masks, what do you do to, I mean, if you've been wearing it, in terms of sterilizing or washing it or cleaning it, or, you know, how do you make sure it doesn't just build up if you are secreting something you shouldn't be?
Okay, so the stuff I'm secreting is my own, so there's less of a risk. But, you know, I have a few of these, and so they get washed every couple of days, and they get just rotated around.
So is there anything beyond just normal washing in a washer and dryer that you need to do?
Yeah, just washer and dryer is fine. The recommendation is that you use moderate to high heat in the dryer. That'll kill this germ. This germ is not a particularly hardy germ, so detergent will break down its lipid barrier, and heat will kill it. It kills it about 130, and so most dryers get far hotter than that.
And I think most people probably understand by now what you're talking about and all these other guidelines you're talking about people wearing is very different than what medical professionals would wear in an operating room, for instance.
Well, so in an operating room, they're wearing a surgical mask. And the reason they do that is the difference between a surgical mask and a homemade mask in other times is just convenience. A surgical mask costs 3 or 4 cents. And so, yeah, you could wear a homemade mask and launder it and whatever, but it's just much easier to wear a surgical mask. But in this time where surgical masks are short, wearing a homemade mask is certainly better than nothing.
Now, is the surgical mask, when you use that term, is that the same as N95, or is there a difference there?
There is a difference. So there are actually several levels of masks. There's the procedure mask, which are the kind of things that you see people wear on the streets in New York. These are usually yellow in color, and they don't fit very well. They typically have ear loops. The next step up are surgical masks, which almost always have ties, usually have a nose piece to make it fit tighter. And then there's N95 masks, which are like that, but in addition have increased filtration, so they block 95% of the particles that come through. So in many cases, you know, N95 masks used to be cheap too. So in some cases, they just use N95 masks. In some places, they use surgical masks. But again, remember, the surgical masks are to prevent the surgeon from putting germs into you. And so they don't have to be super high quality. The N95s are high quality. We use those around, for example, tuberculosis patients or patients with measles, because those germs are very good at getting past a mask.
Now, I know as hospital officials and other health professionals, first responders, people like that, I've been talking about the need to be using those. I saw a post earlier this afternoon that said some people might actually have them in their home that maybe they'd purchased for another purpose. Like a lot of things, people stack them up and they don't use them, that if they haven't been opened, haven't been obviously used at all, that those could be something that could be donated.
That's exactly right. So that, for example, many places that are exposed to fumes or exposed to droplets might have N95 masks around. So we know one of the mills did. We know that some of the painting shops did, because they wear these on a regular basis to prevent them from getting sick. So I've got a few of them in my shop that I use when I use varnish or when I do sanding. So I've got a couple of those. I don't think either of those would be particularly useful, because they really look like a spaceman with those.
All right, going to take a break on Talking Health. More when we come back. Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, County Public Health Officer. In a moment, we'll talk to Laura Turpin, an epidemiologist. We'll explain exactly what that is and more. A special Talking Health as we weather COVID-19. In for Lisa Platt, I'm Kyle Bailey, 423, News Radio 1240 KQEN, back in 2 minutes.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
In for Lisa Platt, I'm Kyle Bailey. This is Talking Health, a special COVID-19 edition. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, an epidemiologist for the Douglas Public Health Network, Laura Turpin joining us. Laura, first of all, I think a lot of people are learning so much about health and medicine as we get through this situation. Just to get everybody on the correct page, what is an epidemiologist?
So an epidemiologist is somebody that tracks infectious disease.
And explain more about what's involved in becoming an epidemiologist. For instance, in your case, what led you this direction as a career?
So I've always had an interest in public health, and I went to school. You studied, typically get a master's degree in epidemiology or related field.
And how did that lead to ending up here in Douglas County, and how long have you been at Douglas Public Health?
I've been working here for 2 years. Prior to that, I was in the Gambia, West Africa for 2 years serving in the Peace Corps.
Wow. So that you've had a very interesting variety of experiences already to work over in Africa and now deal with this in the U.S., and it sounds like it's got to be pretty fascinating work.
It is interesting. I compare it a lot to detective work, but instead of tracking crime, we're tracking pathogens.
So were you always interested in the medical side of things growing up?
I was. Both of my parents are both scientists, and so it's always been an interest of mine. They're botanists.
Very interesting. And so you guys probably have some really unique conversations around dinner tables then.
We sure do.
That's amazing. Now, were you, before you went off to Africa, were you from Oregon originally, or did you start somewhere else?
No, I'm from California originally, and I went to school in New Orleans. So I've worked for both the California Department of Public Health and the New Orleans Mosquito Control Board.
So prior to all of this, in a normal day, if we can remember what normal was, at DPHN, what was your role? What kinds of things were you involved in doing here in Douglas County?
So for my first 2 years here at Douglas County, every morning I would check our online system called Orpheus for electronic lab reports. So there's a list of certain diseases in Oregon that are reportable to public health. Laboratories send us those results at the same time they send doctors. So my job would be to follow up on infectious disease, interview patients, notify other people that might have been exposed, and help get them treated as well.
So talk about what you're doing now with these epidemiology investigations. Explain more about, you know, what the process is when, for instance, you get someone who comes back with a positive case. Where do you take it from there?
So we follow the same process for COVID-19 as we do with other infectious diseases. We call the patient, interview them. In this case with COVID-19, we would make a list of everywhere that they had been and everyone they had come into contact with since being symptomatic and being contagious. We actually go 48 hours before the person is contagious because we know that there might be some pre-symptomatic transmission as well.
So how long are these typical interviews with these folks?
That first interview usually takes about an hour.
Wow. And so then you're writing down or recording or both a lot of this data, and then how do you address first?
The first things we always respond to are medical exposure. So if we fire EMS, was that person transported in an ambulance to the hospital? Then we notify the hospital so they can notify any employees, the ER, nurses, doctors that might have been exposed.
And then where does it go from there?
Then we usually talk to household members, close contacts, and then we try to notify everybody who's come within 6 feet of a person for a prolonged period of time. So that might not be somebody at the grocery store that only had a 3-minute interaction with somebody, but if they spent an hour, let's say they shared a car ride together somewhere, or they shared a lunch time break with each other, coworkers, we would notify those persons.
So even out talking with neighbors and friends, people like that?
Right. And so hopefully if people are following social distancing protocols, there won't be that many persons. But some of the patients that we've interviewed, this was prior to when social distancing measures went into effect. And so they might have had some other contacts. They might have gone to a party or had other contacts like that.
Well, right. And at the front end, and that's one of the things that I remember as this started to evolve is, you know, all the information started getting out there and the encouragement to do social distancing and all of that. But for some of those early cases, whether here or elsewhere, those suggestions, protocols, orders, whatever they've evolved to, weren't even around then. So did you have, with the local cases, more folks having close contacts at the front end and then less as we've gone along?
We have. So usually people, if they're sick, they might wait a week or two to seek medical care, and then it might take us a week or two to get results back. So we're still interviewing people this week that have been sick for perhaps a month, but there's been some delay in reaching those people. So sometimes their recall might not be that good for a whole month ago, but we have certain techniques to prompt their memory. We might have them look at credit card receipts. We might have them look at their calendar, ways to help prompt their memory.
So you ought to be thorough there. So for instance, if let's say somebody was returning an item at a store and that ended up being a 5-minute conversation, maybe prior to social distancing and before it really caught on, then they're going to have to go back and figure out just exactly who that store clerk was, that sort of thing.
Right. And again, we're looking for people who had within 6 feet for a significant amount of time. So maybe not a 3-minute conversation, but an hour, certainly.
Wow. So very precise work, I would imagine. I mean, science, again, is the subject that I did least well in school. But I mean, sure, there are a lot of things there that in research you've got steps that you definitely follow, and you're pretty much held to doing it a certain way.
Right. We follow the Oregon Health Authority investigative guidelines and the guidelines set forth by the CDC. So I know my counterparts in all counties of Oregon, we're all following the same guidelines. Here in Douglas County, we've been lucky in that we're still doing containment. So we are still committed to trying to interview every single positive patient and tracing contacts. If we got 50 new cases tomorrow, we might not be able to do that. But right now, the way our numbers stand, we still are able to contact every patient and help them with any needs they might have.
So talk about when it goes from containment to mitigation. What's the difference there?
So when you transition from containment to mitigation, you might not be doing such detailed contact tracing. You might be sending letters instead of calling everybody. You could be delegating some of that work to the doctors or nurses to interview. It would be a little less aggressive of a stance, because at mitigation, you would be assuming that most of the population is infected, and so that contact tracing has less value. But the way we stand right now, we have about a 3% test positivity rate. So most of the sick people we've tested have not been positive. And so it really is valuable to interview and contact trace the known cases we have.
When we talked to one of your coworkers last week, they talked about this Epi Strike team. How has that evolved?
So I'm the only epidemiologist, well, infectious disease epidemiologist working in communicable disease at Douglas County. And so when this started back in January, Dr. Bob and I talked about how our need might exceed our current staffing capability. So at that time, we had a current staff of about 7 people, and we've since expanded. And so I have 4 to 5 people helping me that are trained and ready to do epi investigations if our need exceeds what we currently have. So those persons are retired nurse practitioners. We have a couple school nurses that are very well trained but out of work right now, and some Aviva employees. So we have a good roster ready.
Wow. And of course, what you hope is that you don't need more of the help, or don't even need to have enough going on to keep them busy.
Right. Well, so far we haven't needed that. And so that's been a huge blessing.
Going to take a break on Talking Health more when we come back. Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Laura Turpin from Douglas Public Health Network. The interview, a podcast at 541radio.com. After we complete the broadcast, we're going to be back in 3 minutes with more on Talking Health. It's 435 at News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Kyle Bailey and for Lisa Platt, Talking Health from Mercy Medical this afternoon. We're with County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and epidemiologist Laura Turpin. Dr. Bob, I was looking, and about a week and a half ago, somebody noticed this site in our office, and I've been checking it out periodically. All the research information, sort of the numbers, you mentioned being fascinated with numbers, on the Johns Hopkins University, one of their research websites, and it's been fascinating to follow that. Is that something you're looking at often as well?
I look at these things several times every day. I like that site. I also like the Worldometer coronavirus thing. They update things by the hour, and so I'm checking that all the time. So there's a lot of data out there. There's a lot of metadata out there, which is big data, some of it which is interesting, some of which is downright foolish. So, for example, last week this thing came out that said people in rural areas are not doing a good job in decreasing their movement. And the answer is, well, you know, if you live on a cow farm in Harney County, or you live on a ranch, you're going to move about the same amount before and after. So some of this big data is kind of silly.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that. And, of course, one of the things that we've seen here is in Oregon, we've had more cases in the urban area. Somebody asked me about that yesterday, and I was trying to explain what you had said last week. Maybe you can do a better job about just all the normal cross-sections you would have every day if you lived, for instance, and worked in downtown Portland versus somebody who's, you know, in Douglas County.
Well, I grew up in New York City, and so living in a big city like that, you have a tremendous number of contacts. You wait in line, seems, for everything. Taking public transport, you have lots of contacts with people along the way. Think about being in a subway car for an hour or so with 200 of your closest friends, and then you wait in elevators and you go to crowded lunchrooms. And so you have just lots of contacts being in a city. In addition, because cities tend to do lots of international commerce, you have lots of people who come from around the world to visit. And the third is cities tend to be wealthier, and so there are wealthy people in the cities that visit travel. And so, for example, when we look at people return from cruise ships, the majority of them are from urban areas rather than from rural areas. So for all those reasons, urban areas do have a far higher tendency to have rapid spread of disease.
Now, as we've followed this along, and there have been different sort of hot zones, or I'm not sure if that's the right term, but hot pockets, different areas where things have sped up more rapidly. For instance, Washington State at the front end of things. Does that mean they are more likely to get on the lower on the side of the curve where they're going back down, or might a particular area, be it there or be it somewhere else, go up and down a few times before things subside?
All right, so the going down on this one, nobody really knows. So, for example, every year with the flu, it builds up, peaks in January and February, and then comes spring break week, and it kind of fizzles away. And by May, flu is pretty much gone. So flu follows this very clear seasonal pattern where it peaks in January, February, March, goes away pretty much in the summertime, and then comes back in October, November, December. This one, we've not seen that seasonal pattern. The reason we've not seen that seasonal pattern is unknown. But, for example, if we look in Australia and Brazil, there are big outbreaks there, and it's clearly summertime already there. And then we're also seeing big outbreaks in the U.S. and Florida and Louisiana, where it's already summertime. So we don't think this is going to follow that seasonal pattern. The other reason that these things sort of blow through a community is when enough people get immunity to it, and that's why we stress, for example, measles immunization. So if enough people are immune, it won't spread. In this case, we think the attack rate in even the most hard-hit community is only a few percent. So again, over 100,000 cases in New York sounds like a lot of cases, but there's 15 million people there. So 100,000 cases and 15 million people means that there's still 14.9 million people who are susceptible to it. So I don't think this is going to end when you get enough community immunity to this. I think this will end because the places that got it earlier initiated strict restrictions before the places that got it later. So Washington already by the 10th of March had pretty strict restrictions. We didn't get strict restrictions until the 23rd. So I think usually what we see, it takes about 30 days of strict restrictions to start to see a downturn in the number of new cases, and then takes another 30 days to go ahead and get the number even lower. Then when the number is just a few and you've got rapid testing, then our epidemiologist can track every one of these down and stop secondary spread. Now, knock on wood, I think so far we in Douglas County have not had any cases that we knew about that then caused another case. So we've been able to track it down, but much of the state and much of the country has not been able to do that.
Well, watching what has happened in Washington and then our response a bit later here in Oregon, any idea when cases in Oregon are likely to peak?
So people have asked me to predict, and predicting is hard, and especially when you have to predict the future. I would think sometime in the next month, the number of new cases will peak. Remember, though, when people are sick with this, they're sick for several weeks at a time. So I would think new cases are likely to peak somewhere in the next month.
And for the perhaps overly optimistic folks, they saw that, for instance, there were around 60 new cases today. A few days ago, it was around 100. So it'd probably be easy to look at that and go, oh, okay, it's going down, but that might not necessarily be the case then, it sounds like.
Yeah, so I have this right up here in front of me, and, you know, over this week we've had, you know, we had 100 cases one day in the 60s before, so really our number of new cases is about what it's been over the last 10 days. There's some up and down, but over the last 10 days or so, the number of cases have stuck in that 60 to 100 range. So I think we're probably, we may be at a peak in Oregon. Now, again, what we've tried to do in this is flatten the curve. And so what flatten the curve means, instead of having a big spike of cases where we'd get 1,000 cases in Douglas County in a month, what you'd like to do is flatten it so you'd only get maybe 20 a month, but then you'd have to get it 20 a month for 20 months. So it would be a long time. And I think that's maybe what we're seeing in Oregon, is that we're going to see 60 to 100 cases a day for a long time. So that means there's a lot of work ahead of us, but that our hospitals will not get overwhelmed like they have in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut.
Now, we've had to deal with, for instance, the closure of school potentially through the end of the year. That was just announced in Washington State today, that they're going to remain shuttered, obviously, with a higher rate up there of folks with coronavirus. What about this summer? And I know this is one of the things that people ask you to do that you're really reluctant to do is make predictions. But, for instance, people are like, are we going to be able to do sports again or outdoor music or different events? Any idea about summer for maybe rural Oregon?
So I think it makes great sense to think about how we are going to move away from this total lockdown kind of stuff we're doing now. And I'm part of a group that's going to be considering how we would do that. But I think there are a couple of things we have to have. One is we have to have adequate amount of rapid testing. If you don't have rapid testing, there's no way to know what's going on. The second thing you have to do is you have to be sure that all the people that have been short on PPE have fully replenished their stocks. It doesn't make any sense to open things up when people are very short on supplies, because then if there's another outbreak, we won't have the supplies to take care of them. The third thing I think you need to have is adequate public health personnel to go ahead and track these cases down. So we are very lucky to have Laura and her team. I don't think people really recognize how incredibly fortunate we are in Oregon. In Oregon, and especially in Douglas County, you have people like Laura that have come and do this work. This is not what I would call glamorous work in any way, but this is really such important work. So we're happy to have them. Much of the state doesn't have those resources. And then the last is we really have to see a sustained decline in cases. So, you know, under the best scenario, come May or June, we might start having restrictions, but I still think we need to be careful. So I still think we probably don't want to crowd ourselves together in the Rose Garden for Blazers game. But could we open restaurants with adequate distancing? Maybe. Could we open hair salons if both the person getting their hair done and the person doing the hair wore masks? Probably. So you can probably think of ways to go ahead and realistically relax the restrictions for people. So do we think camping in the summertime? Yeah, you can be with your family anywhere. Whether you camp with your family in Douglas, you know, at home or somewhere out in the woods, it's probably going to be okay. But I think we need to be smart about it. What I saw today was a thing about what happened in China. They relaxed the restrictions. He had 20,000 people in this tiny little place on top of each other. That's not the right way to do it. I think we'll want to be a little smarter than that.
Going to take a break on Talking Health. More when we come back. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and epidemiologist Laura Turpin will wrap up the program for today, our final segment, after we take this 2-minute break. 449 at News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hi there, Kyle Bailey for Lisa Platt. Final segment with Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, County Public Health Officer, and epidemiologist Laura Turpin as well. Just ahead of the break, Dr. Bob was talking about the potential to relax some of the restrictions as we go on. And that brings me to maybe my next question. As folks try to deal with the current restrictions, and deal with sort of the emotional stress that's going on. You don't work in the mental health area specifically, but it seems like folks that I've talked to, did one interview in particular with someone at South River last week, that this really can be racking people all directions emotionally, even if they didn't have any predisposition to emotional issues.
Yes, so we are definitely worried about people's mental health during this time. So for people with anxiety disorders, just watching the news can be incredibly anxiety-producing. And so we worry about those. We also worry about people who have a little bit of depression who are spending a lot of time inside because we know that being outside and getting sunlight is a thing. So we've encouraged people to go out as long as they can adequately social distance. And then there are people who are extreme extroverts and being by themselves in the house is really hard. And so we've encouraged them to keep in contact with other people as best they can. And we've also encouraged people to go ahead and do nice things for yourself. Sleep in a little bit. If you're on a diet, don't worry so much about the diet over the next 2 months. I mean, over the next 2 months, let's just get through this. So if you have an occasional treat for yourself, don't worry about it. We've told people that they should call relatives. You know, you may not be able to visit elderly grandparents, but you should certainly give them a call. So try to do all of those things to do as best you can. And we do have a hotline here, the hotline here at 541-464-6550. There are people there every day who've heard it all. And so that if people just want somebody to talk to, they should do it. So I was doing the hotline a few weeks ago, and there was this fellow who was so anxious. He said, I think I'm dying of COVID because I can't breathe. And so we talked a little bit, and by the time we got done, he said, you know, my breathing is all back to normal. He was just really anxious and just wanted to talk and tell me his story. So again, we have the people here at the hotline. Give them a call, and I think you'll feel better thereafter.
Well, and as we look at our restrictions here, I have friends who happen to be in a country right now which is on pretty much a total lockdown where only one member of the household can leave the apartment once a day to get basic supplies, and that's a very regulated situation. So for the other people I know inside that apartment, they've literally not been outside for 3 weeks. That's got to be pretty tough.
That is hard. So we do not have those kind of restrictions. And so while we do certainly want people to stay home when they do, it doesn't mean stay inside. So this might be a time that you might want to plant a garden, go out and do the weeds, do something like that, or just take a walk. So I love to take walks. And when I take walks, if I see somebody else coming, I move 10 feet away, let them pass me. That is a perfectly safe way to do it. And walking is a great way to do it. And I think we're going to have nice weather over the next 2 weeks. So this would be a great time to get out, get some sunshine, get a little bit of exercise.
Yeah, and in fact, we're looking at 70 or above starting, I believe, Wednesday through Friday. So a lot of opportunities for that. Now, if people, if their mental health feels more fragile during this time, I mean, people are stressed about so many different things right now. What about, for instance, the crisis line that Compass has available?
I think that is perfectly great. I think that helps. In addition, most of the providers in town are still working, but they're working by telemedicine. So you can, you know, if you have a trouble with anxiety and you have a doctor that you see, please give them a call. Actually, this telemedicine thing we're doing is pretty remarkable in our ability to go ahead and talk to people and help them through things. So I've done a couple of well child visits by telemedicine, and they've been remarkably effective. So I would certainly encourage people to call their doctors or call the Compass line if they're having mental health issues.
And having been a pediatrician for a very long time, it's still got to be a bit odd to see a baby via a phone or a computer link and not actually be able to look directly at the child and the parents.
So we have both audio and video. So when we have video, you can actually see the kids. You know, I kind of miss listening to their heart and lungs and whatever, but I realize that most of the things we're doing in Well Baby is talking about growth and development and sleep and eating, and those are things we can all do very nicely over the phone.
So, Laura, as an epidemiologist, there's no typical day right now with this situation, but it seems like this is one where you've got to be ready for just about any result at any point of the day and be able to sort of make a quick course correction to your schedule.
Right. So thankfully, I have coworker Kristen Rutledge here who helps me. She takes Saturdays. I take Sundays. We've split it on our staff so that we also can take days off and take care of our mental health.
And how important is that for people like both of you and Kristen and others that are really essentially working on this project, what feels like probably 7 days a week, just to be able to get away from it, even if for just a few hours?
Oh, I think it's incredibly important. And I think it's important when you're resting or recharging not to check social media. I went out off the North Umpqua Trail this weekend, and that really helped me, because you're outside of network, so you can't be reached even if they want to. So that's really essential.
And Dr. Bob, we've got a couple minutes left. What other things do you want to share with folks this afternoon about COVID-19 and about how we should be responding?
So the advice hasn't changed. I did this first on January 26th, and the advice is still the same. Take good care of yourself by sleeping well, eating well, and staying connected. To maintain social distancing of 6 feet. If you're sick, please stay home. If you do cough or sneeze, cover your cough and then go home. And if you're out in public and can't maintain social distancing, to wear a mask. And again, I'd encourage you to look at that Facebook video. My daughter had a great time filming it last night.
And where would people find that?
So it's on our YouTube channel, and it's a few down, and we call it Mythbusters. So it's sort of trying to imitate how the Mythbusters would look at why we do social distancing the way we do.
Also on Facebook.
And it's on Facebook too.
Ah, okay. And speaking of Facebook, when's the next time you're going to be doing a Facebook Live event?
In about 1 hour.
Okay, so that's going to be on, and again, Douglas Public Health Network on the Facebook page. Got about a minute left. As you look at this from, let's get past COVID-19 and all of that, but do you think some of these changes in social distancing and some of these things like this are going to be maybe applicable to our society for the long term?
I don't know. So I think it will change things. I think people will definitely think twice about being on a cruise ship, because cruises have really been a source of much, much problem here. But I hope people get back to the point where they still will hug you and give you a kiss now and then. So I don't think it's going to totally change that.
And Laura, any final thoughts from you?
No, thank you for having us, Kyle.
Well, just about ready to wrap up. Again, the interview will be a podcast shortly at 541radio.com. Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, County Public Health Officer, and Laura Turpin, epidemiologist with the Douglas Public Health Network. And both of you, thanks for spending the hour with us to let folks in Douglas County glean from your insights as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kyle.
4:59, the afternoon report coming up with Douglas County's news team on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
The preceding program was paid for by CHI Mercy Health Mercy Medical Center. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.